Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Fire Marshal's Corner. My name is Ed Kamau. This month we're going to be focusing again on the issue of photoelectric versus ionization smoke alarms, which is really a pretty hot topic across the nation right now. Since last month's show, quite a bit has happened, and we really want to bring everybody up to date on some of the changes that have occurred and some of the information that's out there. The first thing is that the National Institute of Standards and Technology reissued its 2004 report on the effectiveness of smoke alarms. In this revision, they had to make deletions to the tables that contain information about the operation of the dual sensor smoke alarms, which a lot of people have been looking towards as a possible solution. It turns out that the units they were testing were not co-located with the other smoke alarms, but were placed further away from the source of the fire, causing them to alarm later than the single sensor smoke alarm. So it really wasn't a fair comparison in terms of the effectiveness of a dual sensor versus a single sensor smoke alarm. Also, the NFPA released a task group report on the subject as well. In addition to the group's findings, there were several dissenting opinions included in the report. Links to both of these reports can be found below on the webpage. Well, one of the dissenting opinions was written by Dr. Don Russell, a Regents professor at Texas A&M, who is joining us today to go over some of the controversial portions of the report and provide us with his thoughts based on his extensive testing of smoke alarms over the past decade. Following Dr. Russell is Dr. William Grosshandler, who's the Deputy Director of the Building and Fire Research Laboratory at NIST. Dr. Grosshandler will be discussing the testing that was done in 2004 and the methodology that went into putting the experiments together that resulted in that report that so many people are looking at right now. And then wrapping up the show is a great discussion by Roger Ricewick, Director of Industry Relations for Simplex Cornell. Roger is going to give us an overview on the technology that goes into making photoelectric and ionization smoke alarms and our great understanding on what is some of the differences between these two so we can have a better understanding of how these devices work. So sit back and listen to Fire Marshal's Corner here on Radio at Firehouse.com.
Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Joining us now is Dr. Don Russell, who's a Regents professor at Texas A&M. Thank you for joining us, Doctor.
Glad to be here.
Recently, NFPA issued a task group report on the whole issue of the photoelectric versus ionization. And incidentally, there's a link to that on the page here. If you look down below, you can download that report and take a look at it. Included in this report was I'd call it a dissenting opinion, from Dr. Russell. And I was wondering if you could just kind of fill us in on what you feel are some of your differences with the way the task group report was issued. What were some of your thoughts?
Well, I'd be glad to give you those thoughts. First, I'd like to say that I know that there's some very good people on this task force who have the interest of the public in mind, and they want to do the right thing to help make people safer from fires that occur in their homes. So we certainly don't want to imply that they have any other motive than to make people safe. But I do have some fundamental disagreements with the report. I followed the creation of the report, participated in providing some information to several of the members of the task group, and also on one of their conference calls and so forth. My reaction to the report is basically that it is too limited and conservative in its approach, and does not try to aggressively deal with the known problems we have with smoke detectors and fire protection in this country.
And what would some of those be? What would you consider some of the problems that we have with smoke detectors?
Well, I have tested smoke detectors for over a decade. Commercial grade detectors that are for residential use, as well as others, and there are some very substantial technical differences in ionization and photoelectric detectors. They do not work the same way. They do not detect the same fire in the same way. And according to the type of fire you're going to have in your house, one or the other of those is going to give you a much better warning of the presence of that fire and be more reliable in terms of warning you. For that reason, I really believe that we must be looking at eliminating the use of just ionization-only smoke detectors in this country, because they are very slow to detect certain types of fires.
Okay, and I think it's pretty well established that photoelectric is better detecting smoldering fires, ionization is better flaming fires. And that seems to be the big point of controversy among so many people is, okay, what type of detector gives us the earliest warning possible of a dangerous
fire? I apologize for talking over you there, but I'm very passionate about this.
Sure.
You just said it correctly. What's going to give us the earliest possible warning? And this is one of my major objections to the task group. I think the task group, in attempting to be fair to everybody, manufacturers of smoke detectors, users, create standards that they can rely on and so forth, have developed a philosophy that we're going to balance all of these forces, and we're going to get people out in time from a fire before it becomes extremely dangerous or before it would hurt someone.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I have with that philosophy is that it does not take into account the fact that there are just huge variations in the types of fires and the people's responses to fires that cannot be predicted. Mm-hmm. And I have a different philosophy. I believe the task group's philosophy should be guided by, we're going to detect every fire as fast as possible and get people warned as fast as possible. No other limitations. We're gonna detect every fire that occurs, no matter how you consider it, whether dangerous or not. If it's a fire in my house, I think it's dangerous. Whether it's untenable or not is not necessarily the issue yet. If I have a fire, I want to know about it as fast as I possibly can know about it, so I have the maximum time possible to get my family out, to remediate or deal with the fire in various ways, to call responders, etc. And a few minutes can make a huge difference.
Oh,
so that's my philosophy, and I think if we guided the task group by that philosophy, that we're going to give the fastest possible warning to every single fire we can, mm-hmm. that it would change the way we do fire protection in residences.
Yeah, because reading from, and this is a quote in the task group report that was drawn from NFPA 72, you say, fire warning equipment, and I'm quoting, fire warning equipment for residential occupancies shall provide a reliable means to notify occupants of the presence of a threatening fire. So I guess the real question is, well, what's a threatening fire versus a non-threatening fire?
Yeah, I
agree with you that every fire is a threatening fire.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that language is, maybe it's carefully crafted, but in reality, there is no such thing as a fire in a residence that's not threatening, as far as I'm concerned, because they can all develop into something that is very dangerous. There's just no such thing as having a fire that's not an abnormal and dangerous condition in a hot residence, and everybody should know about it as fast as possible.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned in your reply to the report here is the smoke detectors you've tested have performed differently than those in the NIST experiment. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can. The NIST experiments did not take into account the wide variation in performance of the same make, same model kind of detector in fires. Admittedly, they did not intend to do that. I objected before the NIST experiments that should be one of their parts of their scientific protocol, because it was a huge issue. And they took it off the table and said, we're not going to test for that, and we're not going to deal with that. That was their choice, but I think it was a mistake. I have taken significant numbers of smoke detectors off of the shelf at some big box store, Walmart or a Lowe's or a Home Depot or someplace, taken the same make, same model detector right off the shelf beside each other, put them into fire situations where in a full-scale fire in a house, and measured the differences in response times between those detectors. And if you take a sample of 8 or 12 right off the shelf from a big box store and put them into that fire, you might well get the following results. One of the detectors won't work at all. won't detect the fire at all. Three or four of them will go off so late that the house is completely full of smoke, and the rest will go off in a scattered fashion from the time that the smoke gets above 10 or 15% obscuration up to 30 or 40% obscuration. And that's a terrible performance. That's the same smoke detector.
I mean, that's pretty interesting, given that, you know, they're all tested to the same standard when they're manufactured, right? I mean, when they leave the factory, theoretically, they should all perform identically.
That's the problem, is that, of course, UL tests are done originally on the designs, and then there are samples that are tested, thereafter and so forth. But every smoke detector that comes off of an assembly line is not tested in an actual fire situation, as you well know. And there are variations in performance of the components and the way they age and all kinds of other factors, the way that the sensitivity settings are varied on the detectors. I mean, there's a wide variety of technical reasons why you could get this performance. With ionization detectors, one of the big problems is that unless you have a lot of velocity to the smoke moving across the detector, pushing it into the chamber, they are just really, really very insensitive. And when you get on those margins of sensitivity and smoke velocity, you find that you get incredibly different performance out of those same make, same model detectors. And that simply wasn't studied in the NIST test. We've demonstrated it. I've shared that data with NFPA and CPSC and others. And it's a huge issue that remains until this day. The problem with that is that that cannot be addressed directly by the UL testing unless they are willing to say we're simply not going to use standalone ionization smoke detectors like we have today. The only way to address that problem with ionization technology is to basically incorporate a photoelectric detector right next to it.
And I'd like to talk
about that's the one that will work.
Yeah, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about dual sensor technology. That originally was in the NIST report that was issued, and the revision they did just last week, they deleted most of the references to the dual sensors because they were not actually co-located with the single sensor units, so it wasn't an apples-to-apples comparison. And I know that a lot of fire marshals that I've been talking to had been looking at dual sensors perhaps being the solution to the problem. But I'm trying to gather more information on that. What's been your history with dual sensor type technology?
I'll be glad to give you that. First place, we objected strongly to the way that the NIST protocols were done and that they didn't test enough smoke detectors in one location side by side, and they didn't test a substantial number of unmodified detectors that were simply bought off the shelf just like a consumer would do. And so there were some big issues I had with the numbers of detectors and the way they were placed and so forth with the NIST tests. I'm not saying the NIST tests weren't accurate for what they tested. I just think the tests are inadequate to draw conclusions. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we have two issues with the dual sensor detectors. One of them is that it makes all the sense in the world to have a photoelectric detector detecting the next slowly developing smoldering fire you have. And it also is the case that an ionization detector will give you tens of seconds to a minute or maybe 2 minutes max kind of warning in advance of photoelectric detectors if you have a really fast developing raging fire. So one could easily argue that if you have both, you should be better off. One of the problems, however, is that some manufacturers have actually desensitized the chambers, the ionization and photoelectric chambers, when they put them into a combination detector in an attempt to address false alarm problems. And therefore, when you buy a combination detector, you may actually not be getting as sensitive a detector as if you had bought two individual standalone devices.
And is it still
That's a problem.
Is it still within the limits of the standard, the desensitization?
It is. It certainly meets the UL standards, but it's desensitized in the sense that you could potentially have a fairly substantially slower fire be detected much, much later. than you otherwise would have.
And a dual sensor, is that an or condition? It's either the photo or the ionization goes off. It's not an and condition, correct, where they both activate?
Generally speaking, we're dealing with just an or condition. I mean, there are some more sophisticated ways to combine the outputs of the sensors. Mm-hmm. That has been tried and used in the past, where you would and them together or some sort of complex logic. Right. But in truth, it's fair to say that the OR condition is the main way that they have been used. But again, if you desensitize them, you've got a problem. One of the things that I found interesting about the NFPA report is that they say if you want the full protection, you could use both technologies. So you could put in a ionization detector, and right beside it, you could put a photoelectric detector. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to do that, and they're going to have full sensitivity for both of those detectors, then it doesn't make any sense to have a combination detector that's been desensitized.
Right.
What's the difference in having the two chambers under the same plastic?
Mm-hmm.
If you're recommending that people buy an ionization and a photoelectric and put them right beside each other, why wouldn't you have the same sensitivity on the two separate as you would for the two under the same plastic housing? It doesn't seem to make sense to me that you would recommend one versus the other. So I'm just opposed to the principle of solving our problem by desensitizing the chambers.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem realistic, too, to expect people to be putting two smoke detector side by side up on the ceiling.
Well, I have to tell you, that's what I do in my house. But that's because I have tested lots of things and lots of fires, and I do exactly that. I have some ionization detectors that I believe are very sensitive
mm-hmm.
from my testing, and I have some photoelectrics that I believe are sensitive, and I do put them, scatter them out in the residence, but I also do put them effectively side by side. So you're right. It's not something you'd kind of be able to explain to the public to do very easily, but I have told friends to do it, and I have done it myself. I'd rather see us come up with a really good combination detector that meets a higher level of UL standard and gets us out of this guessing game the public's in about what to buy.
Put yourself in the shoes of a fire marshal out there. Is there some way to determine the sensitivity setting on a dual sensor? I mean, is that something that's on the packaging, or will the manufacturer tell you?
I don't think there's enough uniform or marking or understanding of what's there for most people to be educated to make a decision about all of that. There are several questions you'd have to ask about how the sensitivities were set, mm-hmm. whether there was anything other than just a pure OR condition, like just a race condition to see which sensor goes off first. Did they do some other kind of logic in it to look at both chambers? I mean, there's all kinds of questions one would have to ask about what's inside the combination unit. I think it's impractical to expect that even a fire marshal would be able to go through all that exercise without talking to the manufacturers and having them answer all the questions.
Now, some of the other things in going through both the task group report and the appendices that have the dissenting opinions, we'll call them, one of the things that came up was, and you alluded to this earlier, was the philosophy that we're using in terms of how smoke alarms are being used out there. You know, we're hoping that people will have interconnected smoke alarms on every level, in every bedroom, that sort of thing, which would be an ideal. I mean, I know personally I do, and you probably do too, but, you know, when you look at the general public, how many of them are actually following that type of installation criteria? And since they're not... Are we designing for what we hope they do, or should we be designing for what they're really doing?
I think that's an exceptional question. I think that both the NIST tests and the committees of NFPA and so forth have basically predicated their study of all this under the assumption that people are going to follow the rules,
mm-hmm.
That people are going to follow the recommendations, that people are going to follow the standards, et cetera. I think that's I think that's way too optimistic. Mm-hmm. I think that the vast majority of apartments in this country still have one smoke detector in a small hallway leading to the bedrooms, and that's the only thing they've got.
Right.
I think the vast majority of housing in this country does not have interconnected smoke detectors. Mm-hmm. I don't know of a single one of my friends that own residences today, unless they were built with a wired a monitored system, and I know a few friends that have that, where they're monitored by the police and or by security system. Unless that, I don't know any of them have an interconnected system. And so, you know, it's a situation where I think our expectation of all of those things is just way too high. I think we should come back to reality, recognize that it will be a long time before we have sprinklers in houses, before we have fully interconnected systems, before we have all this other stuff. Recognize that we need a standalone battery-operated smoke detector that can be bought at a big box store and put on a wall or put in bedrooms and in the hallways that will give exceptionally good protection. And we need to focus on that. And then the rest of the stuff just adds to the safety, right? But we ought to focus on that one thing and not preclude set a predicate that you've got to follow all the rules or we're not going to help you. Right. So that's my opinion, is that that's what we need to focus on. Let's get a good standalone, non-interconnected, battery-operated, in other words, for retrofit, where somebody can just go buy it and stick it on a wall like a homeowner might do. Mm-hmm. I know we need wired systems. I know we need AC-powered systems. I know all of that. We all know all that. But we desperately also need the kind of thing where some person who just rented an apartment can go buy a smoke detector off the shelf, expect to get a really good device that's sensitive and well-made and reliable, that's going to perform well in the next fire they get, and get them out as soon as possible. And I don't think you can do that by just using an ionization smoke detector like is made and sold today.
Right. Well, it certainly seems like this whole task group report hasn't really settled a lot of the issues. In fact, it probably looks like it's actually raised more than it is resolved, I would say, in reading through it.
My objections that I wanted on the record, and it certainly was not an exhaustive list, but actually what I said first was I don't really want to put in objections. What I'd like for us to do is to spend more time, not put this report out yet, mm-hmm. answer some more of the questions, and discuss this longer.
Right.
That suggestion was not accepted. That's their business, and they decided to print it anyway. And as a consequence, I said, well, then I want it printed with my concerns, mm-hmm. if at all possible. And it's where it is. I hope that the questions that it raises, which I think are a considerable number of questions, will be addressed in the future, and we will not let this sit. We'll just have to see what they do with it.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Dr. Don Russell, who's a Regents Professor at Texas A&M, about the NFPA Task Group report that was just released on photoelectric ionization. Really appreciate you taking the time, Doctor.
I'm glad to do it, and hope that this, along with all the other things that everyone's doing, yourself, us, and others, will help make the public safer.
Well, I think it will, and I think the big message we also have to send out to the public is that, you know, any smoke detector is better than no smoke detector. You know, it's important that you do have them in there and you do have them working.
Absolutely.
Maybe we can do better, but, you know, you at least have to have something there to start with.
Yeah. By what I tell people is buy often and install a lot of them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Russell.
You're quite welcome.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And joining us right now is Dr. Bill Grosshandler, who's the Deputy Director of the Building and Fire Research Lab. Thanks for joining us, Doctor.
I'm happy to participate in this conversation.
We asked Dr. Grosshandler to come here to talk about the testing that NIST has been doing on smoke alarms, particularly the photoelectric and the ionization ones, back in, I think it's 2003 or 2004. NIST did a pretty comprehensive study and put out a report on it. And so we'd like to discuss what's been happening with that because, as you're well aware, that's a pretty hot-button issue right now. So I guess the first question I have for you, Doctor, is really what was the genesis of this study? Why was it done in the first place?
This study was done, and it actually started in 2001, early in 2001, was to re-examine the current situation with to determine whether or not the smoke detectors, smoke alarms that were being installed in housing today, or this was back in 2001. How they had changed over the decades since the DUNES testing done in the 70s, mm-hmm. how fires may have changed during that time. And this was something that involved support from and sponsorship of many organizations, including the NFPA, the Center for Disease Control, the U.S. Fire Administration, Underwriters Laboratory, and there were others, I think, that were actually participants in CPSC, right. Participants in helping us develop the test plan more or less responding to our results as they came out.
And since we'll probably be referring to it, I just want to mention that the DUNES test that the doctor mentioned was a full-scale test. I think it was about 75 that thing was done, where you actually did some full-scale testing in homes to evaluate the performance of the smoke alarms.
That is correct, and that was back, as you said, 30 years ago.
Right.
And that was work-sponsored. Also, it involved the Underwriters Laboratory and our predecessor organization, the National Bureau of Standards.
So how were the tests structured? What was the testing that was done?
What we were looking at, one of the major objectives, was to see the level of protection provided by different strategies for smoke alarm sighting. That is, the NFPA was NFPA 72 was making some changes or considering some changes, and it had to do with the number of smoke alarms in a house and the importance of having additional increasing the number and their location. So the premise was that we wanted to first set a baseline that is in comparison to the original tests, in which there were really a single I can't remember exactly how many smoke alarms were installed in the DUNES test, but the main thing here was to compare the performance of a single detector on each level of a home to a detector that was outside each bedroom and then a detector that was in all the rooms, and to determine whether or not the value associated with increasing the number of detectors would increase the life safety of the homeowner.
And you used
so that was the major objective.
Right. And you used two different types of buildings, too, in this testing, didn't you?
We did.
Different geometries?
Yes, we used a two-story house that was slated for demolition, but it was made available to us. And we also had a manufactured home that we had within our own laboratory, so we had very, very good control over the conditions in that manufactured home. In the manufactured home was a single level, but it had multiple rooms. The house was multiple level as well as multiple rooms.
Okay. So then the various fire scenarios, how did you establish what kind of fire scenarios to use?
Well, we proposed scenarios that would be relatable to what was done in the 70s study and what we call the DUNES study. This was discussed with the advisory group, which included representatives from all those folks that I mentioned earlier, NFPA, CPSC, CDC, and so on. So we had a test plan that was well vetted. And agreed to as making a lot of sense, and from our standpoint, from a technical standpoint, it dealt with the fires of concern, which would be a fire in a living room, in furniture, a fire in a kitchen, a fire in a bedroom, and we were looking at both the smoldering and the flaming situation.
And in reading through the study, I noticed, too, that you did a statistical analysis to determine, you know, what kind of fires are out there killing people. You know, is it a smoldering fire? Is it an open flaming fire? And that sort of thing that correlated to developing the test protocols.
That's correct. Well, yeah. We were very aware of, we were not interested in looking at the boutique fires. We were interested in the fires that, in fact, are killing people.
Okay, so now we have different geometries. We've got two types of fire scenarios. Smoke detector placement and smoke detector types, you know, how did you organize that part of the testing?
The placement was based upon the NFPA 72 and proposed changes to NFPA 72 for new construction. So that they were placed either, as I said, one smoke detector on each level or a smoke detector outside the bedrooms, smoke detectors inside every room. And so that's what we were, that's how we decided on the placement. And as far as the type of smoke detectors, we picked on the ones that were prevalent at the time, or that were there were new detectors. The technology that was prevalent in the just after 2000, 2001, and that was actually being installed. And we wanted to get a variety of detectors. We were not our purpose was not to evaluate one particular detector design against another, simply to establish baselines of effectiveness. So we had ionization type detectors, we had photoelectric type detectors, we had thermal detectors, we had CO detectors, which are not fire detectors, but they are being used a lot these days, and we wanted to evaluate to determine if there was any additional information provided by them. We had a few dual ionization photoelectric detectors, which were thrown into the suite. And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was in because we had so many different technologies, and we had to. What we did was we had a number of detector boards. These were essentially plywood sheets, about 2 feet by 2 feet, in which we mounted an array, upwards of six detectors at each point. The idea being that we wanted to co-locate these detectors so that they were respond to minimize the effect of transport, or make sure that they are all seeing the same smoke and heat. We did not have enough detectors to include the full suite, every location. As I said, that was not our intent. We were trying to get some idea of the range of response, but our primary goal was simply to compare the value of multiple locations to determine if people would have sufficient time to egress safely.
Now, were these off-the-shelf smoke alarms, or were they modified in any way? Or, you know?
These were, most of these, I was not involved in the actual purchase of these, but my understanding, and this is documented in the final report, my understanding is that most of these were off-the-shelf. There were a couple, what we wanted to do is actually to monitor, since this was a research effort, not a smoke detector certification effort, we wanted to be able to read the voltages continuously from the sensors. So in some cases, it was easy for us to do that in-house. That is, we simply tapped off at the appropriate point in the electronics and routed that to our data acquisition system so we could look at the voltages that were being generated. In other cases, we were not able to get easy access, and so we asked the manufacturer to provide a port for us to get a continuous voltage output. And so to the extent that there was modification, the modification was simply to the electronics to allow us to do a continuous monitoring of the voltages.
Now, obviously, the big role of any smoke alarm is to sound an alarm before untenable conditions are reached. So now you have to kind of develop that threshold, you know, what is an untenable condition? which I know is a big part of the study. How did you go about that part of it?
Well, in fact, that really was not a big part of the study. What it was is that we took the recommendations from the literature based upon ISO standards and a previous work. So we did not develop our own tenability standards. We reported what standards were being used, and as you know, Ed, this is an area which is very difficult and is constantly being looked at as to what is the appropriate threshold, whether we should be looking at a threshold or whether we should be looking at an accumulation for some of these other compounds other than, say, CO. So that was not the purpose of the study. What we did was simply take what was recommended from the literature and reported what the thresholds that we used were. Mm-hmm. And then based upon that, we tried to assess whether or not an individual in a different part of the building, whether they were in the room of origin or whether they were elsewhere, would they have sufficient time to escape. And by the way, on this, we actually were not, I said the room of origin, but in fact, we were not looking at tenability for someone, say, who was actually in a bed and that was smoldering or on fire. We were looking outside the room of origin. What were the tenability conditions there?
But I mean, you were measuring tenability.
We were measuring the environment. We were measuring the temperature. Yes, in addition to the smoke alarm itself, mm-hmm. we measured the temperature, the carbon monoxide, the carbon dioxide, in some cases the hydrogen cyanide and some of the minor species. Mm-hmm. That was being generated along with the oxygen and so on. So we had information, including information in the room of origin that could be used by those who care to use that information.
Right, and that played into developing your available evacuation time.
That is correct.
Safe egress time and the required safe egress time.
That's correct.
Right. Okay. What'd you find? Okay, so you did all this setup, and what were the results?
Well, the results were in some ways unremarkable, and other ways were revealed some very, very interesting things. The overall finding was that if the detector where the smoke detectors now were, I'm referring primarily to the traditional photoelectric ionization or the dual detectors. That properly installed and maintained ionization and full electric alarms do provide enough time to save lives for most of the population under many fire scenarios. So we have those qualifiers only because we didn't look at all scenarios, and there are some situations where we're unable to establish the viability of because, for example, there are some portions of the population which are extremely sensitive maybe to some of these combustion products and they are deaf at the same time. So therefore, there could be double conditions that would make it very difficult for them to safely egress. Mm-hmm. So that's why we had those qualifiers most and many and so on. We also found that along with what has been found traditionally, that the photoelectric detectors did perform better from the standpoint of earlier warning in the smoldering fires, and the ionization detectors, again, consistent with past results, in general, were able to respond a bit sooner in the case of the flaming fires. Mm-hmm. In a smoldering fire, because the smoldering fires were much longer, the actual difference in minutes between the alarm of the photoelectric detector and that of the ionization detector was longer in time intervals, but in either case, both the photos and the ionizations in almost all situations provided sufficient time for people to escape. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty much consistent with what we had found in the past. Mm-hmm. The fact that we were finding that the fires were growing significantly faster from the furniture sources than they were in the tests conducted in the 70s, showed that there was a concern about new construction. So it had more to do with the construction of and the furnishings that we put into these structures than changes in the technology for smoke alarms. And so the importance of being able to alert folks inside houses more quickly was pointed out by this more rapid deterioration of conditions in these fires.
Now, this report, which first came out in 2004, has been through several revisions. The latest one was just last week. And one of the big changes that was taken out of it was the performance of the dual sensor smoke alarms that have both an ionization and a photoelectric in it. My understanding from talking to some of the folks up there at NIST was that the results had in the tables reported them right alongside photo and ionization, yet these units were not co-located with the single sensor units, which, you know, they were saying, well, that's why they took much longer to react, because they were further away from the fire than the single sensor ones. So those were taken out of the new version, which was reissued last week, I believe it was. So, and unfortunately now it's, you know, a lot of people, and I've been talking to a number of fire marshals across the country, have been looking at dual sensors as kind of, I hate to use the phrase, but almost the magic bullet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this controversy about photoelectric and ionization, which is better. Well, let's put a dual sensor in there. And it looks like now, well, unfortunately, we don't really have information to go back to now on the performance of these types of units.
Well, we, as I said, this the intent of the study was not to compare all these different types of technologies per se. Mm-hmm. Was to look at the siting as to how many detectors, and it's in the conclusion from our study, which is which we stand by, and although you are correct that there have been some revisions. None of the revisions, while they have made clear, they've made reading and understanding the report easier for those who have not delved into detail. None of our conclusions have really been modified through these changes. And the most important conclusion is that the NFPA, the current version of the NFPA 72 for new construction, is what is recommended, which we strongly endorse, and which our study has indicated is the right way to go, and that focuses not on the type of detector, but the number of detectors and their location.
But I mean, clearly, too, I mean, even though the report might have been focusing on sighting of the detectors versus the type of technology, depending on the type of fire you're going to have, obviously one is a better performer over the other. You know, ionization for flaming and photoelectric for smoldering fires.
Mm-hmm.
Which really raises a question that, you know, and I'm kind of looking at it from the perspective of the fire marshal out there, well, what do I recommend? You know, what do I tell people to put into their homes and where and such? And unfortunately, it kind of looks like there just really isn't a clear answer on that, unfortunately.
The advice I give to fire marshals, and I speak to fire marshals all the time on this, is that follow their recommendation should be NFPA 72 for new construction, and then the question is, what about existing construction? Well, that's a local jurisdiction to decide whether or not they are. I mean. There is a lot of there are anecdotes out there and some tragedies that have occurred, which we have not investigated ourselves, but which have led people to the concern that the ionization detector is not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
But now I don't know that what is clear is that a single smoke detector in a residence is not sufficient to guarantee the safety of people. That is a conclusion which we can stand behind, and we would not defend that a single ionization detector or a single photoelectric detector or a combination detector, but just a single one would provide the homeowner with the safety that they're looking for.
Well, I mean, I don't think you'll find many people arguing that, you know, more is better when it comes to smoke alarms in a home. But, I mean, this is really an issue that's taking off. I mean, just just within the past 3 days preceding this recording of this podcast, there have been at least a dozen stories across the country in newspapers about the fact that, you know, there's this problem with smoke alarms. And I think the unfortunate thing is the public might be looking at it with a broad brush approach that there's a problem with smoke alarms, where there really isn't. There's, you know, smoke alarms we know save lives. There's no two ways about that. It's just what type will react differently, and that's what.
Well, again, I think we know how different designs react to different kinds of fires. That's pretty well been verified by our study, as well as a lot of other folks. NIST is conducting research as we speak to really assess the problem of, or this issue surrounding smoldering fires, and whether or not an ionization detector located properly is giving a false sense of security, let me put it that way. So we are looking at smoldering fires, and we are looking at specifically comparing the performance of different technologies. We are making the measurements of the smoke particles so that we can actually quantify what's there. We're looking at the CO levels. Just the fact that you see smoke in a room without the alarm going off is, while it may be disconcerting, it is not necessarily an indication that there's a severe hazard at that moment. So we are going to try to quantify exactly how quickly a room, say a bedroom or living room, deteriorates due to a sustained smoldering event in that room, as well as in adjacent rooms where you've had a chance to age the smoke to cool it down, and so on. So we're going to try to, because there have been enough concern raised and enough anecdotes and statements from the fire service, from fire marshals, that we certainly are not ignoring those, and we feel that NIST is the right place to really answer this question, since we have we do not make the standards, and we do not support any particular technology. What we want to do is provide the answers and the data upon which both the detector industry and the regulators and the local jurisdiction can make a reasoned decision and to develop their own public policy.
What stage is that research at?
It's a 2-year project, and there's no other than a general outline of what it is we're going to do. We are very overloaded in our large fire laboratory at NIST. That is, we are extremely busy. So we are trying to work trying to coordinate all our testing, and this is scheduled, I think, later in this year. Hopefully we'll have some preliminary data by the end of the fiscal year, but that's our goal. It's a 2-year project, so it just started now, earlier this fiscal year, and by the end of next year we will have a report out. We are certainly looking at the UL data carefully. And we are we talk with UL all the time. I'm on the fire council, and this is an issue that if in fact a revision to the standard is necessary in order to capture a hazardous environment that is not there, we hope to provide the standards making organizations with that information so that they can develop a reliable standard test method. We aren't. It's premature to say that there definitely needs to be a change, but we definitely do need to develop the understanding and the data necessary to make that change if we determine that makes sense.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. This is an incredibly complex issue, and just within 30 minutes, I know we've tried to cram a lot in there, but I really do appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Sure. I'm happy to provide that information. And if there are any questions that come up in the future, just give me a call.
Will do. We've been talking to Dr. Bill Grosshandler, who's a deputy director of the Building and Fire Research Lab. And we've been talking about the issue of the photoelectric versus ionization smoke alarms. There's a lot of information that we covered, but there's also a lot more information available. So if you look below on the webpage, you'll find some links to some additional information on this. Thanks for listening.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
And joining us now is Roger Reiswig, who's the Director of Industry Relations for Simplex Grinnell. Thanks for joining us, Roger.
Hi, Ed. Good morning.
We asked Roger to join us to go over the technology that's involved in the design of a photoelectric and an ionization smoke alarm. As you're well aware, there's a lot of discussion going on right now about which type is better at detecting smoldering and flaming fires and such. And what I think that the listeners out there need is probably a little bit of better understanding on what's the technology that's involved in the design of these things. So maybe you can fill us in a little bit, Roger?
Okay. No, I'd be happy to. Basically, there's two technologies that are in use today by almost all the manufacturers, and that's an ionization type of smoke detector and a photoelectric type of smoke detector. An ionization type smoke detector is a chamber that we actually inject a little bit of radioactive material into. And typically, the industry is using americium. And we send a little bit of a electrical charge through that chamber, and we monitor that. And as combustible materials, molecules, sometimes gaseous molecules, enter that chamber, it will disrupt that conductivity of that field. And when we see it go down to a certain point, the device will go into alarm. So it's actually looking for some kind of a molecule to disrupt or to change that ionic field that radioactive material has created. Photoelectric works a little bit differently in that we have some kind of a light source. I say some kind because according to the UL 217 and 268 guideline, you can have an LED, an incandescent bulb, some kind of a way to make that light. And typically the industry is standardized on an LED because of longevity, a lifespan. And the LED will transmit a beam inside the chamber. And the chamber has to be black, and it's got a labyrinth that air has to flow through because any outside ambient light could cause the device to go into alarm. So there is a photo sensor that's about maybe a 60 to 70 degree angle off of that LED on the opposite end of the chamber. And what we're looking for in this type of detection with a photoelectric detector is for molecules that can reflect light or reflect light into the photo sensor. So we're monitoring that photo sensor, and when it gets to a certain point, when it's excited enough or it sees enough light being reflected into it, it will activate at a predetermined level and go into alarm. So that's basically how the two technologies are working today.
So what makes one different than the other in terms of detecting the different types of fires? You know, photoelectric is good at smoldering. Ionization is better at flaming. What makes that happen?
Well, I guess what's really going on here is with the smoldering fire, we have visible molecules. We have usually black or gray type of a smoke. And when that enters into the chamber of a smoke detector, a photoelectric smoke detector, those molecules are reflected, those black molecules are reflected into that photo sensor and enable it to go into alarm. Contrastly, a photoelectric device, if a fire is flashed, a fast flaming fire, maybe like a grease fire or something like that in a kitchen, there really isn't a lot of smoke at first in a fast-flaming fire. You just have those ionized particles, combustible particles that are in the air. And when they enter into a photoelectric detector, there typically is nothing to reflect that light that can create that device to go into alarm. Now, when we look at ionization, typically when you have smoke or smoldering fire, there's a little bit of ionized particles, combustible particles in the air, but there's also a lot of reflective particles that can be transmitted into the detector. And an ionization device typically doesn't see those as well as a photoelectric does. But when it's a fast-flaming fire and we have those ionized particles that are combustible, an ionization device is able to detect those very quickly. So it really depends on what your application is as to which one may be better or more applicable to a certain application.
All right. Let's talk about dual sensor for a minute, because to a lot of people out there looking at this whole issue of photoelectric versus ionization, dual sensor seems to be perhaps the optimal solution to it, but also some information starting to come out now that maybe it's not quite as much the magic bullet as everybody had hoped it would be.
When you use a dual chamber or dual sensor technology, a lot of manufacturers are doing it differently, and I guess that's the biggest point within the industry is there's not one standard way to do it. And there can be dual technologies where it's a photoelectric device and a heat detector. Sometimes we have to back up and we need to define exactly what is the multi or combination that is being used when we talk about a combo or a dual sensing detector. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we're talking about a photoelectric and an ionization device.
Right.
And what that's doing is, and what the silver bullet was that people are looking for, is a device that can pick up both the fast flaming fires, those ionized particles in the air, to detect those quickly, but then also be able to detect the smoldering fire, paper burning in a trash can, or somebody threw a cigarette butt into a couch or something like that. But in the industry, when we do that, typically you have to write some kind of an algorithm and to use both together. So I'm looking for a little bit of ionization, a little bit of photoelectric. When each gets to a certain level, the device would go into alarm. That's pretty complicated when it gets into the mathematics of making that happen. And what some manufacturers have done is created a footprint of what a typical fire would look like if you had a trash can smoldering, or if you had a grease fire, or if you were in a computer room and wires were catching on fire under the floor. And then they'll take those footprints and then embed them into the device.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the device can use multiple footprints, and it's dynamic, and it's able to see the different characteristics and able to go into alarm. In other cases, you actually need to tell the device you're going into a computer room, and you need to have the footprint of a computer room. Problems with those are a lot of facilities nowadays are changed often. They'll go from being a computer room today to being a storage closet to general office use, or who knows? So you would need to be, your mindset would have to be out there that you need to make sure that the device is capable or still is in the proper application for what it's what it's looking for.
How about the combination units that would be used in a residence? I'd have to imagine that those are not as sophisticated as the ones you're talking about that would go into a computer room. They'd have to be more generic, in other words, to go into a residence, because who knows what kind of conditions they're going to encounter.
Exactly, and the ones that I was referring to with the footprint, they're more when they're tied back to a master fire alarm control unit. Mm-hmm. But the ones that would be more for a residence, those would be what we call a smoke alarm detector. Usually in the industry, we talk about smoke detectors and smoke sensors. Usually when we say sensor, we're talking about a data gathering device that sends information back to a panel and then or a fire alarm control unit, and it decides when the device goes into alarm. And they're the more sophisticated type. Usually when we talk about a detector in the industry, we're referring to a device that has the smarts, if you will, built into the device, and the device is capable of making its own decisions and then either activating a SON alert or a contact closure back to a panel if required, or a tandem connection to other devices.
Mm-hmm.
So in a residence, you're exactly right. We're looking at an ionization and a photoelectric within the same device, and there are several manufacturers that make those today for a single station, as we refer to those, for a residential occupancy. And they're doing basically that. They're somewhere they're settling upon an area that when I see a certain amount of radioactive material being disrupted in my chamber, or I see a certain amount of light reflected into my photo sensor, I'm going to activate the device into alarm. I guess I don't want to say a problem, but the situation could occur is, well, what point do you allow a photoelectric to go into alarm without seeing ionization, or vice versa?
Right.
And I think that's what the industry is kind of running into a problem with that silver bullet, if you will.
So the smoke alarm, the combination smoke alarm that we'd see in a home, is it what we would call an and condition, where both the photo and the ionization have to go into alarm, or is it an or condition where either one going into alarm could activate the unit?
You know, it really depends on the manufacturer, because I've seen both ways, and I've seen the third way where it'd use a algorithm that uses both ion and photoelectric, and it goes into alarm, or it can just see the ion part or just the photo part. And some even have heat detectors that, when it sees the heat detector go off at 135 degrees Fahrenheit, it will go into alarm. So it really boils down to the manufacturer, and I think that's where we're we're running into the confusion where, because it's not just clear cut when we say, okay, I have an ionization device and that's all it is. Everybody pretty much knows how that works. When we say I have a photoelectric device and it's within this sensitivity range that UL puts out, that we all know how that works. But when you talk about both of them together, now you're getting manufacturer specific. Right. UL will test individually how the ionization part works in that device and how the photoelectric works in that device and then put them together. But there really isn't a set guide that when you have a combo device, this is how it must operate.
And the manufacturers have some latitude on setting the sensitivities of each of those sensors, don't they, and still be within the UL standard in a combination.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes, UL has a spectrum, if you will, from 0.5% obscuration to 4.0% obscuration. And a manufacturer is allowed to sell a device that is within that range. Some devices actually have adjustments on the device where you can change the sensitivity of that device if you want it more sensitive or less sensitive,
really?
Depending upon the environment. And some actually use the fire alarm control unit to, when it's gathering that information from that sensor, to tell it when you go into alarm. You might have some areas you want to be more sensitive than others. If you're doing a large high-rise building, maybe in an electric room or a computer room, you want it to be more sensitive than it would in a main lobby or out by a loading dock.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm a fire marshal out there and I want to call for, let's say, dual sensor smoke alarms in a house, is there some way that I can look at a unit? Is there some way I can get the information in terms of how this unit functions? Is it an AND condition? Is it an OR condition? What's the sensitivity to each of these sensors? Is that something that is easily decipherable from the box or the unit, or do you have to go to the manufacturer to kind of get that information?
That's a really good question. And right now, from the devices that I've seen out on the marketplace, there really isn't a clear distinguishing mark that tells you that says that it's an AND gate, an OR gate, I need this much ion, this much photoelectric for it to go into alarm. Some are even introducing carbon monoxide as a third sensor, and some are using thermal.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting maybe even four sensors in one device. But for a fire marshal or an AHJ to look at a device and say, this is the type that I want, that really isn't out there. You do have to go to the manufacturer and really get into how does your device operate.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'd mentioned some other sensor technologies there. I mean, is there something coming down the road that is going to help improve this level of detection that's happening in these residential units that we can look forward to in a few years?
Well, I think a lot of manufacturers are looking at the NIST reports, the DUNES studies that they've done, the DUNES 1, the DUNES 2, NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technologies. And we're looking at that, and then we're also, as technology is evolving, should we have a photoelectric device that also has some kind of a carbon monoxide device in with it? Is photoelectric good enough by itself? Is ionization good enough by itself? And I think we're all really still in that data gathering stage right now, trying to figure out, is there a best detector for every situation? I don't know if there really is. We might find out that it's really going to have to go back to what are you trying to protect in your facility. Maybe combination device is better, photo is better. It's still really kind of out there. Now, I think carbon monoxide is a big leader in that. We're looking for carbon monoxide devices to give us that maybe a little bit extra of an edge for early warning to help save lives.
I mean, and as you're well aware, there certainly is no end of controversy as to what is the better kind of detector. But I think the one thing that everybody really has to keep in mind is that any smoke alarm is better than no smoke alarm. That, you know, they clearly have a track record in terms of saving lives over the years.
Oh, that's exactly right. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
Wow. Having a smoke alarm, smoke detector, tandem then is even better if you're in a residence application where if one goes off, they all go off to evacuate or to allow the tenants to know that a problem exists. You're exactly right.
One of the issues, too, that has led to the proliferation of ionization out there much more than photoelectric is a cost issue. What makes photoelectrics cost so much more than an ionization?
Well, with photoelectric, again, you have to have some kind of a light source that's always on, and you have a photo sensor that always has current flowing through it looking for light to be reflected into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that inherently is going to take a little bit more power than just an ionization type of a device. And then also it comes down to battery backup for that device. Whether if you use 120 volts to typically power the device with a 9-volt battery for battery backup, and it's a pretty power hungry type of a device. So that's going to drive the cost up.
Well, I think that's one of the things. If the manufacturers could somehow bring the cost down, then I don't think it would be as much of an issue in terms of getting a lot of this out there as well.
Right, and with new LED technology, I mean, we see LEDs in use in almost everything nowadays. I mean, there's even some regular incandescent light bulbs now are being replaced with LED type of light bulbs because the brightness, the illumination of the LEDs and the amount of current that they draw has gone down dramatically. And I think we're going to start to see that in the fire alarm industry as well. It's going to start to transverse into that. We're also starting to see that where we have LEDs being used for visual indication for our strobe lights.
Well, we've been talking with Roger Ricewick, who's the Director of Industry Relations for Simplex Grinnell, about the technology that goes into photoelectric and ionization smoke alarm design. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us, Roger.
Oh, thank you, Ed. I've enjoyed it.
And I think this gives us a good wrap on some of this issue. The show today has really had a lot covering the different aspects of it, and Roger's discussion really gave us a good understanding of the technology involved. So, with that, hopefully we can go a little bit further in terms of putting some of this to bed, in terms of the discussion, the controversy, and move forward in terms of making a great decision on it. Well, you've been listening to Fire Marshal's Corner here on radio at firehouse.com. My name is Ed Kamau.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio at firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website, www.firehouse.com/radio.